had a difficult time putting into words who James's works reminded me of. There were some lines that recalled epic poetry, and some lines made me think of Cohen, and I think it's really beautiful when you can write in that way and there's no kind of obvious influences. But I think focusing on his skill with language, the flexibility he has with the line and sounds and cadence would do James a disservice. To invert Kant's maxim, this is poetry that uses history as an end to a means. That is, these poems venture into process through result, exploring truth through the fixed outcome of histories, the personal, the mythic, or horrors of the 21st century. These are all, they serve to anchor the reader in an experience of perspective. These poems don't so much allow you into a deeply intimate moment as consciously you'd already and always been there. They take you into their pocket of life with the sort of openness even the closest of friends aren't privy to. They are generous with their honesty, as generous as they are vulnerable. Sometimes I dream of saplings growing through the caverns of my eyes, one poem tells us. James Dunnigan's poems themselves are like trees, extending their branches upward with effortless elegance, their roots complex, but never arrogant or assuming. It is both a pleasure and a privilege to read with him this evening. James Dunnigan is a poet, scholar, and fishmonger from Montreal. His first book of poetry, The Stained Glass Sequence, won the Frog Hollow Press chapbook competition in 2018. Shortlisted for the Gwendolyn McEwen Poetry Prize in the same year, his work has also appeared in such places as Maisonneuve Magazine, CV2, and Montreal Writes. The second chapbook, Wine and Fire, is forthcoming with Cactus Press. Please welcome James.
Thank you for that
also kind introduction, Willow. And thank you all especially for your extraordinary performance this evening. And that's a tough act to follow, I must say. So, all of these poems are about candor. And candor is, for all of its merits, a violent form of, you know, a violent behavior in certain ways. And a lot of these poems deal with violence or violently with violence of all kinds. And for that reason, I would reiterate the sort of content warning out of courtesy that Willow gave for her poems. I would say the same for mine, especially as they deal with atrocity and a great deal. But to begin with, maybe something a little less so. Two poems from my upcoming chapbook, forthcoming chapbook, Wine and Fire. One's about a mother, the other one's about a father. So I'm going to start with the one about the mother. It's called Mother Reads Her Son's First Novel. That afternoon you sat 2 hours observing the street and asking me, can I come in, can I come in? But it was warm for winter, 4 o'clock, mid-March. The sun and all the other lights of day, the changing lights, settling beside you, your first solitude. A stick between your thumbs, playing with it the way you'd play a flute, the kind you'd play at school. You hiding then, spotting my face between the window drapes. Why were you so afraid to play that song when I discovered it? Some things, I guess, like others, do you keep to yourself, and I keep to myself. And even a voice is a place to hide. You do not come here anymore. Nowadays are not so much to you. Your nights are not for me to watch, except through others' eyes. Your throat was grown from mine, your fingers and your arms. Sometimes I sing myself and think my voice is yours. Sometimes I wrap my face inside the drapes and think the branches in the winter night are shaken by your hands. Next poem is about the father. It's called Woodworks. This one was published in CV2 just last year. Woodworks. My father, when he was a kid, he would play football in the morning and the violin the afternoon, and coming home by that old garden choked with seed which no one ever cared about, one day, along Rue des Érables, he cut a moon-shaped langue de bœuf from some dead maple parched for sap which had, for years before they felled it, burned with lichens gray and blue, and in the soft white inner flesh he carved his name. Presumably next to the name of Annick Ullianin or of Sophie, who introduced my mother to Mort Rosengarten at some bar on St. Laurent, where his friend Leonard, rest his soul, hit on her, saying, "Hi, I'm Leonard." "Yeah, I know, Leonard." And that's the story of how my father wasn't Leonard Cohen. It was long before my father met her. It was not on this occasion that, with knife in hand, he opened up that space that each man carves within himself for love, at least not for the love for which he carved me up, from which I'm carving this. I think of my father so often, I know he often thinks of me not sure what way, or if he ever thought of what would later be me back then. But in these scenes that forest in me, full of strange eyes, unknown trails, he lays his palm onto whatever tree he wishes, hands eager to grasp the bark, his knuckles crackling as though there were a fire in his skin. This next poem is about a character from a poem I love very much called the Aeneid, which you may know of. It's about Dido. Dido, otherwise known as Elissa in her native Punic, was the legendary founder of Carthage, which we know through Latin as Carthage. And the story goes like this. Sometime after she's founded or is building her city, which is her own creation, she happens to host a band of refugees from Troy, among whom is their leader, Aeneas. Meeting with Aeneas and hearing his account of the atrocities of the war and his flight from Troy, Dido falls in love with him. Aeneas, however, being in love with her as well, is destined, being a son of Venus, to go and found a new home for the Trojans in Italy, which later grows into Rome. This is the story of Dido, as I understand it, and taking place during her last moments, as she kills herself when Aeneas leaves. This is what Dido of Carthage said, launching her words like ships to sea. "It is this world that leaves, not me. What is all this without my eyes? What is this city without me? This morning I asked my sister to build an altar to the father gods, intending not to worship but to kill myself on it. I figured then they'd get it. In Sidon, before all this, before you, I was a married woman. When father died, my brother took the throne and killed my husband. I was then triply nothing, woman, not virgin, wedded to a corpse I had once loved. But then I realized when Iarbas came to me in suit after I built the citadel, all husbands are like corpses, their wives' tombs. And I don't want a tomb even after I die. I do not want them huddling falsely to a marble face, praying my soul in politics, binding my spirit's arms to war. To war I've gone enough with you and with myself, who battles you and her and you. I do not want them calling me under our goddess sign, hymning my body at new birth, which never held a child. I do not want them worshipping the womb I've kept to myself. I would have given it to you, and then they would have called me whore. I want to know if you can tell me who could have deserved me as a mother, who have pleased me more than you, Aenea. Aenea, who is that? A palindrome, the two-winged word that folds me in the middle, Aenea, who unfolds his sails under the eagle's wings to Italy. Aenea, what are you chasing there? Aenea, what is it that you seek? Aenea, you would be a king by fate, but I have ruled by choice, chose to remain. I could have followed you, if only then to close your eyes, sword of my own in hand. Chose to remain because I am yours even with your eyes at sea, my own before the flame. I've often asked myself, what is a person? And a voice inside me answered in a language not that I had never heard, but which I had forgotten. And it didn't say to me a choice, it said a hesitation. And I never understood. I think I've understood. It is our freedom which unpersons us, a sea or flame in which to throw ourselves as you have done, constantly looking to horizons that disdain your eyes. My love, I am too weak to live like that. Too strong not to. This I commit myself and you and me together to the flame, my hesitations end. The altar now is ready, and its fumes I see throw far the smoke of sacrifice. And if a breath of ash should wander far enough to swell your sails, breathe in and know that it is me. Look at all this. Look, sister, how the sparks glance to our Lord of the sky. And is he glancing back? Can you see he is glancing back? The next two poems I'm going to read to you are from a long poem that I wrote 2 years ago called American Carnage. And as its title suggests, it deals with, carnage. And the two poems I'm going to read to you as part of that series center on experiences my grandfather had as a neurosurgeon in Hungary during the Second World War and then fleeing in 56, when the Soviets invaded. He had a very, very full life. And these two poems are about that life. And the first one is a story he told me, which I tried to render as close as possible to the way that he told me, essentially. Obviously, that's impossible. But I want you to know that this is a true story, most of it at least. Some years ago in Debrecen, the Rendershig, the police that is, imprisoned a man for stealing. He was a dairy farmer called Seip Imre, with land in the country near to the town of Kishvarda, where besides his cattle he owned two wells, a plum orchard, some apricot trees, and a distiller for the brandy which he sold in bulk at a village tavern, and from which he drank a considerable portion himself. During the war, much of his orchard had to be cut down for firewood. Not having enough fruit anymore, he sold his distiller. On account of the loss of his income from these two assets and of the death of one of his cows in an accident with a Waffen-SS tank, Seip Imre soon found himself without the means to earn a living. One night, during a blackout having no food, he snuck onto his neighbor's land and stole two chickens, which he ate with a bunch of the last season's dried apricots and a liter of what was left of his brandy, and got very drunk and shat himself the morning after in the middle of the road while he was on his way to town. The Rendershig found him there, passed out and bleeding from a number of orifices, and carried him in his dangling shit-filled pants back home. Worried for his well-being, they waited for him to wake before they left. When he did, they laughed, and he gave them some brandy, and with night falling, the Rendershig gone, he drank himself back to sleep next to a pile of chicken bones. 2 days later, they came back with machine guns and arrested him. "But where do you come in?" I asked my grandfather. "Where are you in all of this?" He explained to me that he had just come back to Debrecen from Vienna, where he had completed his studies in neurosurgery. They had torn his passport at the border. His country needed him, the border guard said before heading to lunch. When he came back to Debrecen, Seyp Imre had been condemned to death. He had never heard of this man until the Rendershig knocked on his apartment door. They came with an officer of the local garrison, short, bald, and wearing small round glasses. They told him they had a first real doctor's job for him. They gave him, he said to me, a pocket watch, a monster of a timepiece, large and heavy like a small grenade, outfitted with a large gold chain. The Rendershig took him to a car and drove him to the local jail. Seyp Imre was waiting there, standing under the noose by a priest. The flag of Hungary stood low and heavy like a drape close by. He didn't notice the man's face until they slipped the black cowl over it. All he could remember was the man was older than him, had a beard, and that he smelled terrible. "Your job," they said, "is to count the time." And I realized, looking at the hooded man, who is no longer a man, no longer a face or even a body, because being bound he seemed to have no arms, no legs, and being hooded now had no face, that I would have to count the time it took for him to die. And I wanted the man to die quickly. And then I realized what I was hoping for. And I think that was the worst part. And that I thought that that was the worst part made it even worse. And I stood ready and held the watch up to my eyes. I wrapped the chain around each of my fingers and around my wrist. They kicked the little ladder out from under him. I started to count. I could only think of my hand which held the watch. I had trouble holding it up. And then I realized it was because I had been holding it up for 7 minutes. I looked up to the gallows and saw the rope still shaking. And it went on and on and on, James. On and on and on. Kedves Unoka, dear grandson. I was the age that you are now when the Battle of Stalingrad began. Far from my home, from which I'm even further now, I heard of massacres and 100,000s on both lines, long fields and black tanks moving in the sun like whales through mud and burning villages. Hungarian volunteers, Italians, Romanians slogging in arms, hands soaked in the hair grease of the recent dead, lips spattered with the blood of friends whose names they'd never known to say, who spoke their grief in fumes against the smog of gored roads and outhouses, men wounded with hand grenades, one's forearms hanging from a thread of bone, and eyes half fallen from their caverns. And few enough came back to look on Budapest again. I used to watch the bombers from the hospital in May descend over Margit Sziget, listening as Soviet rockets choired in the ripe, cold fog in answer to their engines, asking myself how many times I've asked myself how many lives have bought my own, and with my own in whose will I invest, whose life buy with the rags of mine. Before I cut, I draw his face and mark the scalpel's course in pencil on the borders of the skull. A portrait of each man I operated on lies in my notebook, scarred in places you would never dream could be disease, or broken like a vase is broken or the plant in it diseased. Sometimes I dream of saplings growing through the caverns of my eyes. Do not, my grandson, blame yourself before the mangled dead, nor jail your heart and thoughts or of death or me. Don't hide behind your grief. Its veil is not the veil our mothers wore sometime in wartime in the villages to hide their face from overeager sun or from a soldier's eyes. Though only death in face of this will hide, and only death keep warm, and only death hold you forever in the end. Say to yourself this, my sweet grandson, in the end, your eyes are not closed yet. something a little on a different note now, I think. And this is a poem for a friend who is unfortunately absent currently in Toronto studying HD. It's for Julia. My friend is the Ionian sun. Her laughter is a silver mirror in which I notice multitudes. Between the motions of her hands, around the beating half-drunk pint, a choir of scholars argues God, the changing gestures of his grace. And singling out one golden thought, the current of our talk, has threaded like the ocean threads the stone light of the moon, her gaze into the violet night under a weave of Belmont smoke extends a private question and a smile. I have one last poem, but before I do read it, I would like to thank Miranda, Professor McLaren, and everybody at Poetry Matters, as well as the Anti-Café for hosting us this evening, which has been a privilege to attend, and thank you all for kindly coming to listen to us. This last poem is called Thoughts on Emptying Childhood Bedroom. The day I was born was the hottest that year, a Saturday morning, June 18th, 1994, in Montreal, the Royal Victoria Hospital. The year of the Rwandan genocide and the death of Richard Nixon. White roses opened in my mother's garden. Cars traveled their ways on uncrossable streets. She explained to me when I was a kid that I was born in the time when the roses bloomed. She measured her time in seasons of this kind, which she made up, timed the earth's rotation with what came out of it, crocuses, snowpeas, pumpkins. Winter was a strange time because she wasn't in her garden. It was the non-season, non-time. Of course, this lasted most of the year. Is made for strange time habits. I grew impatient. I hated wearing watches. I hated long lineups. I hated fire alarms. Very early I discovered God. He pulled me to him without naming himself, not quite in the sky, but the space that stood between it and me. I knew he was watching me. I used to be afraid he was walking behind me. I turned back every time and I thought, I can't catch him because he's faster than me. I learned his name only afterward, asking a priest what I-N-R-I meant. His answer was, it's in Latin. So eventually I learned Latin. I was terrible at it. I'd had people convinced I knew Latin all through high school. I let them think so. I fell in love with every girl I met. I made a bouquet of dandelions. There was a spider in it. I almost threw up when I had my first orgasm. I slept with an older woman who drank Heineken and taught me to finger and smoke. I went to Europe. I saw the statues at Hushaktera and trembled. I laughed in the brown waters of public baths with old men. I touched a bullet in the wall of a Pest apartment. I walked in the ruins at Margitsiget and imagined I was Margit left there to rot by her father, the king, and thanks to God for sparing his realm from the Mongols. I dreamt once of falling in love with a woman whose sexual fantasy was to be served at a banquet and eaten, and becoming brokenhearted when dumped for refusing to oblige. I had a vision once of the gates of heaven refusing to enter. I found a book I dictated to my mother called L'Arbre de Dieu, about a tree God plants to carry his voice to people on earth like a giant wooden megaphone. A reverse megaphone, one that turns your voice to a whisper. I wrote that God was sick and a storm was coming to earth, and the tree warned the people it was coming. When the storm begins, the story ends. In the back in crayon I'd written, c'est une très belle histoire. Thank you.